Welcome to the BMJ's podcast on decolonizing health and medicine. I'm Jocelyn Clark, the journal's international editor, and I've come to the BMJ with a real passion and commitment to decolonial and equitable practices in publishing and editing. This podcast is part of a larger project at the BMJ to contribute to debates and progress towards decolonizing institutions and knowledge systems in health and medicine. We've been listening to and learning from experts and colleagues around the world, and they tell us that present inequities and lack of progress in health are linked to a failure to confront colonial pasts. We invite you to listen to these conversations with these experts, and we welcome your feedback.
Hello, and welcome to the first podcast in our series that considers the complexities and sensitivities in decolonizing health and medicine. I'm Rich Hurley, an editor at the BMJ. The term decolonizing health, for many of us, might initially bring to mind historical injustices, perhaps of most significance to the people in countries colonized by the UK and other European powers. But as this series unfolds, we hope to explore how prejudices and biases in the ideas and structures created in those colonial days continue to persist today in medicine, science, global health, and your everyday clinical practice. It's on that last point that we're focused today. I'm joined by a panel of guests to discuss the ongoing clinical effects of colonialism. Amali, may I start with you?
Hello, my name's Amali Lokugamage, and I'm a consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist based in London and an honorary associate professor at UCL Institute for Women's Health. And I was asked to decolonize the medical curriculum, and I didn't actually know what that meant in about 2018. So we held a public engagement event, and it was from then that I really understood that decolonization involved listening to the people, listening to grassroots opinions. It's not top down like the traditional equality, diversity, and inclusion agenda. And from medical education, I've sort of diversified into decolonizing maternity care and also global health.
Thank you, Amali. Great to have you with us. Thirusha.
Hello, I'm Thirusha Naidu. I'm a clinical psychologist from South Africa. I practice mostly as a clinical psychologist, but I'm also an associate professor in the Department of Behavioral Medicine at Nelson Mandela School of Medicine at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. And I'm a senior research fellow at University of Cambridge, Department of Public Health. My research interest is in decolonizing medical education through the lenses of theory and around infectious disease. But I am also interested in health promotion, health-related psychology, especially around infectious disease, TB, and HIV.
Thank you so much. Great to have you with us. And Subhadra, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Subhadra Das. I am a historian and I write about science and society. I'm an independent scholar now, but I was formerly curator of the science collections at University College London, which people may know includes a thing called the Galton Collection. Probably should have been better called the Eugenics Collection. And so my forays into understanding the histories of race science and eugenics was very much an occupational hazard, but I am nonetheless hugely committed to and passionate about understanding our history, the history of science particularly. It's really important to know where we came from if we know where we're going to be going.
That's great. Thank you so much for being here this morning. And Annabelle, hi.
Hello, so I'm Dr. Annabelle Shomimo. I'm a community sexual reproductive health ST6 and author of Divided, Racism, Medicine and Why We Need to Decolonize Healthcare, which I wrote essentially to discuss some of my journey through medical education. I came through to decolonize colonizing work through looking at reproductive health and how we talk about the body, talking about racial stereotyping, where our ideas come from. I founded Decolonizing Contraception about 6 years beforehand, which is now called the Reproductive Justice Initiative. I'm also a part-time PhD candidate and Harold Moody Scholar at King's College London, and my PhD thesis focuses on the experiences of Black women in Britain with fertility control methods, so very much looking at population discourse and the history of eugenics and how that feeds into the experiences that some people have today.
So I wondered, and we've touched in some of what you've said already on the sort of tangible ways that medical practice is today informed by historical colonization. But I wonder if you can give a few more examples or go into a bit more detail, perhaps starting again with you, Annabelle.
Yeah, so a big question. There are so many ways, and I think the way that I chose to approach it was, or I'll try to approach the answering of this question. Again, I'll go back to my book because I did it in a chapter by chapter way, because I also wanted to think through some of these issues. So as a community sexual reproductive health registrar, I very much came through this work looking at reproduction and sexualization of the body. And that is an area that comes up a lot, because in this area, particularly obstetrically, which I know Amali can also speak to, there are a lot of health gaps when we look at Black and brown women, not just in the UK, but globally, when it comes to maternal mortality rates and even neonatal mortality rates, and why we have those gaps. So when we talk about the treatment of people in the UK when they're pregnant, which for various reasons is considered a more vulnerable state, because we know that people are more subject to violence from their partners, a range of reasons, mental health issues, all of these things, the maternal mortality outcomes of Black and brown women, we know, are significantly worse than their white counterparts. Now, people have tried to look at the many reasons why. Yes, some of this is because of the structural reasons that people find themselves in, whether that's housing, socioeconomically, but then there are also the stories that we hear about medical silencing quite often within the medical system, particularly around pain and people not feeling like they have their concerns listened to. And when you think about the history of gynecology and obstetrics, there's a very deep-rooted kind of history in the fact, particularly around Black, but also Indigenous populations, that they were just able to reproduce really freely without a care, didn't experience any pain. If you look at writings from Benjamin Moseley, who was a plantation doctor, or you look at Edward Long, who was a plantation owner, a lot of these writings were being drawn upon by people in the colonial Caribbean to make points about what was happening there. They write quite clearly about Black and Indigenous women of being able to give birth and not experience any pain, or the fact that they reach sexual maturity earlier than their white counterparts. And they had no evidence for these things. The reason they were writing them at the time was to justify the oppression and the breeding of Black women on the plantation. And people say, oh, this history is not relevant anymore. But actually, first of all, a lot of people don't even know this history. But then we see regurgitations of these ideas and these thinkings within our medical spheres and settings. For example, there was the case in the UK of Delissa Parks, who died. It was put down to actually having, she had a kind of feces megacolon, and that obstructed her birth, but she'd been going in saying that she was having difficulty for a while. And actually, one of the things that the obstetrician said and came out in the report is that they said that she had an African pelvis, so the reason that the baby was sitting that way, it didn't matter, that just happened kind of to Black women. And you should go look at the case. Her family set up a foundation. So these ideas that bodies can be racialized and certain features or characteristics are attributable to a group of people because of the color of their skin are still really still very much prolific. We still study medicine that way. And this is why we need to really think about where this has come from if we're going to kind of remake this system and reshift. I just want to say a couple more things, and obviously this spans other areas of medicine beyond sexual reproductive obstetric care. I've just chosen that as an example. The other area that I'm really interested more and more thinking about, and I mentioned looking at my own family's history. So I'm of Nigerian descent. Obviously, Nigeria, you know, is a relatively new country, full of lots and lots of different tribes. I'm Yoruba specifically. My family has been tied to the UK for generations and generations and generations. One of my great grandfathers was actually a colonial doctor. My grandma came here in the 50s as a nurse and auxiliary. My dad came here in the 70s as a senior house officer and to become a surgeon and now GP. And I think what people also don't understand is how countries in the West uphold their own medical systems through drawing on labor forces from the global South. We can't maintain our healthcare systems here, particularly the NHS, without drawing on other places. And that means brain drain. And yet we often construct the idea that these nurses or these doctors are not intellectually good enough. I've experienced in that myself, people interrogating where I've trained as well. So that is also a colonial history and legacy. It's not a coincidence that we have the 75th anniversary of the NHS and the 75th anniversary of the arrival of Windrush in the same year. That's not a coincidence, and it's been constructed as a coincidence. And that's also something we need to think through as we think through the long-term sustainability of the NHS. Can we sustain this health system whilst engaging in brain drain? And what does that mean for the rest of the world? So I'll leave that there. I could say a lot more, but I know my colleagues have lots and lots to contribute.
That's great. Thank you, Annabelle. I just wondered, just coming back to what you said about racialized bodies, and wondering if you can just suggest or give an illustration of how that persists in medical practice today. Is that in guidelines? I think in your book, you talk about body mass index. I don't know if that's a good example to mention. How does that racialization of bodies persist in practice today?
Yeah, so one example, as you said, is kind of the body mass index. So the idea of kind of dividing people into categories of, you know, underweight and overweight and obese, and how that was pushed to the fore, similarly at a time where we had you know, the idea that we were trying to find the category of the normal idea of man. So the idea of what is the middle ground, and the focus on what is the middle was very much through colonial conquest and trying to say, okay, white men are the norm and everybody else is very distinct from that, and how to create measurements that basically spoke to that idea. And it's not saying that we don't need maybe a measurement within medicine to measure weight, and, you know, whether this drug might have higher implications for somebody. It's just the fact that the body mass index very much was born out of a period where the reason we were trying to create measurements of the normalness was not because for that reason. It was more focused at trying to justify who deviated from the norm, and trying to say, if you deviate from that norm, maybe you're not going to be the best reproductive specimen, and feeding into some of those eugenic ways of thinking. So maybe we need to now start moving away from things like the BMI and think about, now we built up more knowledge, you know, whether looking at other measurements, you know, whether that's like abdominal fat or things like that we know actually have higher implications, or doing away with some of these measurements altogether. Other examples, you know, people have talked about the measurements that we use, for example, when we look at blood pressure medications and pathways for blood pressure. If you're of Afro-Caribbean descent, it's you get a different drug to if you're white. And actually that construction of what it means to be Afro-Caribbean is completely arbitrary. The most of the studies initially were done in the US. You know, the health condition of people African Americans is very different to people that are considered of Afro-Caribbean descent elsewhere. And we still have these very clear divisions made within health about belonging to certain racial categories, even though we know these racial categories are very poorly, they're not real, then, and they can't be well defined, and they don't hold across borders, because and I'm sure this is something that Therusha can speak to more, you know, in terms of the history of South Africa and how these are moving social categories that are created for political meaning, and then they take on meaning in science, and then people try to justify them scientifically. So yeah, when we think about measurements, BMI, we're looking at pathways that happen with drugs. We still have these with this racialization that happened. And I think a lot of medical professionals are taught not to interrogate that. I certainly was.
That's great. Thank you so much. Well, maybe you want to jump in there, Therusha.
Yes. So I say facetiously to people that I like to think about race in South Africa in the same way that some people think about being an ethics specialist. You know, if you're a specialist in ethics, you call yourself an ethicist. But if you're a South African and you're a specialist in race, you have to call yourself a racist. So being South African, I must say that I'm a racist, because this is how South African society was constructed. This is how we were schooled in different schools, in even at university. I transitioned to a Black university halfway through my training. So I did my graduate training in a Black university and my undergraduate training in a kind of just colorizing university. So being racist is part of the South African psyche. And I say that facetiously because I think it is part of global psyche, except that in South Africa, it is foregrounded in our consciousness. We're experts at it, and we know how to hide it when we need to and how to foreground it when we need to. But that doesn't happen as easily in other contexts. So going on from that, in the tangible ways in which imperialism and colonialism affect medical health and healthcare, I think I want to focus on two particular areas that I work in, and that is in medical education. And medical education scholarship and research. And this relates to what Annabelle said, where there is a vicious cycle where scholarship and education are self-fulfilling prophecies. They write what needs to happen in the world, and then they go ahead and prove it. They create hypotheses and then mine the evidence to prove those hypotheses. And this goes on forever. The danger of that is, of course, that we send scholars and to conferences, and we send students out into to be clinicians with ancient ideas planted in their heads, and we expect them to take their whole careers to realize that this that they've been taught in medical school or that they've read in the journals are essentially a pack of lies created by what Animal talks about there as, you know, the white norm. And what we talk about in decolonial theory is the zero point perspective, the white male perspective around which all other perspectives revolve and emanate from. And we internalize these lenses from medical schools and from graduate clinical training in whatever health professions we are. We internalize these lenses, and then we go and try into the world and try to find this evidence. And we consistently prove ourselves wrong, and we consistently try to find evidence that isn't exactly there. And then we start to delude ourselves that the people who don't fit into this lens, women, Black people, people of color, people speak different languages, are then the failure. They are the wrong, the other, the failure, and they've caused their illnesses. They're not the right size. They're not the right kind. They're not the right background. They don't understand. And this, it boils down to a very micro, I would call it micro clinical relational level, in the sense that we don't learn how to read people's facial expressions, affect. We judge any kind of interaction as we internalize the zero point perspective. Even if we are Black or we are brown, or we are a woman, we look at our patients and we look at the world through the lens of the zero point other. And for me, that is a kind of devastation to myself as a woman and a person of color, in a sense that unless I constantly act my racist self and look at the world as if I am looking at it through a white man, I am doing the same thing to my own patients, especially in a highly emotional state, especially when I'm not thinking. I might even do that to my students. For me, the colonial and imperialism that affects medicine and healthcare is really epitomized by the fact that we ask our students and our scholars to internalize that zero point perspective and police the system of medicine and education for the empire, which still exists veiled through us.
Can I jump in and add something to that? Because it's so powerful. And I'm so grateful to Thirusha for speaking so honestly about, you know, that's a conflicting and a powerful thing to have to live within your own practice. So I'm grateful to you. But I do want to emphasize this point that the nature of medicine, yes, epitomizes male and white as normal. And there's three other branches that's important to add into that. So white and male is the start, but non-disabled, rich, and not fat, I think, are the other three that I would definitely add in. Whenever I talk about eugenics, I think it's important that we acknowledge what eugenics did was it made race into a broad church. It applies all of these aspects of our physical and mental being in the world. And yeah, the idea that there is a normal this idea of healthism, the idea that those people who conform to the norm, those people that we perceive of as believed to be healthy are somehow morally superior to those who are not, and therefore are more deserving of healthcare or more deserving of other things within our society. The fact that certain people going in to see their doctors, or possibly even avoiding going in to see their doctors because how they feel stigmatized by a healthcare system, is something that medical professionals really should be concerned about. If it is the case, and I'm convinced it is, that medical professionals want to provide the best healthcare they can for their patients, they need to be mindful of, as others have said here, a historical colonial frame that really shapes how we talk about people deserving healthcare.
And just, sorry, to add on to that, I know this may be apparent, but just to your listeners, because we didn't define eugenics. Ultimately, eugenics is for the better breeding of society. So the reason where the idea that those characteristics make you, you know, better in terms of hereditary, going to add to the value of society. So the closer you are to that ideal norm, the idea that everybody else doesn't matter, shouldn't matter, and they can just disappear, essentially, so we can push and put our better foot forward, essentially, because society will be better for it. And I think it's important to emphasize that a lot of people still subscribe to these ideas on some level, and we do see it in our politics as well.
Shall I jump in now?
Could you say? Sure, go for it, Amali, please.
But just responding to your initial question about the persistence of colonial prejudices within healthcare, Annabelle talked about the disparities in maternal mortality between black and brown women and white women. We see this in the UK through the Membrace report, and we see this in multiple reports within the US. And this is a colonial legacy. Sometimes scientists, when initially faced with these figures, I remember a few years back, was sort of saying, oh, there must be a flaw in black women. That's why they die more. And that ties into the kind of broken bodies, kind of eugenics type of ideology that persists within medicine. But luckily, over the last couple of years, with the rise of understanding of decolonization, black and brown women have spoken up saying, actually, there is systemic racism. That's why we die more, because you don't deliver healthcare to us. You are prejudiced against us. And this has been picked up in the UK in two reports in 22, in the Birthrights report and the Black Black Maternal Health Report. And that's the best evidence so far in a qualitative way that it's structural racism, not broken bodies. And we can also see from the Membrace report that these disparities between black and brown bodies and white bodies exist even with babies, with neonates. And there are disparities there, and there is a higher mortality and morbidity. This has brought, for instance, the NHS Race and Health Observatory to publish a report out last month looking at diagnosis of jaundice in black and brown babies and also cyanosis and how to better that. Because, for instance, the Apgar score was a score that looked at newborn well-being, and one of the points was colour of skin, that to score an optimal point you have to look pink, which it becomes very tricky if you're highly melanated. So the report, for instance, from last month did look at using pulse oximeters perhaps as better judgment of cyanosis in babies. Although pulse oximeters too have a diagnostic bias, and it's harder to detect cyanosis in darker skins. So people are looking at that. And then again, jaundice in the neonate, where it's harder, or we're not trained. We haven't been trained through colour atlases of what jaundice looks like in darker skins, which can lead to excess morbidity and mortality related to conicteris. So those are tangible, persisting prejudices that we, from a medical educational perspective, haven't taught healthcare to serve people with darker skins. And then if you're talking about medical education, there is a clear publishable attainment gap between black and brown people involved in higher education, in medicine and in obstetrics and gynecology. I also want to mention the fact that there, from a global perspective, there is a geographic bias which is seen on published maps of knowledge and knowledge production of science that show that most of what is called the norm or highly scientific comes from the global north and specific institutions, and not much knowledge production has come from the global south because of that sort of global north, global south bias. So that really needs to be unearthed. The fact that what we call knowledge, the truth, is undergirded by a bias in traditionally white male institutions that may now have many women, for instance, in my own speciality in obstetrics and gynecology, there are about 50% women. But although in terms of equality and diversity, we should increase representation, minorities and women, the insidious nature of the structural way in which we acquire knowledge in healthcare means that we can, even as a woman, be enculturated into a patriarchal interpretation of healthcare, of the way we diagnose, of the way we manage, of the way we have policies, of the way we innovate and prioritize where research funds should go. So there are many, many ways in which that kind of prejudice, colonial prejudice, persists and are invisible unless you take the decolonial lens. And lastly, on the point, Sabrata's point of disability, having just had to cope with long COVID and emerging out of it myself, I'm very conscious about the way in which society is very ableist. And long COVID is a kind of mass disabling event that happened after COVID. And there isn't much recourse to solving or helping the problem. In fact, resources are being taken away from a huge burden of individuals, more than 2 million. So that is that persistence of, if you're not, deemed able, you can't pull your weight in society or receive healthcare in order to contribute in the way you can with reasonable adjustments. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Amali. So, I mean, just would you all say that current healthcare, current medical practice continues to push eugenicist ideas or practice? Subhadra, what do you think about that?
Thank you. I was just going to say, maybe it's slightly easier for me to say this because everyone else on the panel is a medical professional, and I have said I do not doubt their goodwill in terms of their practice. So my general working principle, having learned about eugenics and the history of eugenics from the late 18th century, most across the 19th century, and then coming into the 20th century, is the main thing we need to remember about eugenics is that it never went away. And Annabel made a very good point. I tend to be so immersed in this discourse that I forget that other people may not be familiar with what the terms are and what they mean and what they signify. Eugenics is a British invention. It was the invention of a British scientist called Francis Galton. He's the person who coined the term. And I'm not going to go into too much of the detail of the history. Suffice it to say that Galton was a racist, he was a colonialist, and those ideas shaped his science and shaped his research. And one of the things that's important to point out is that he had very close relationships as a working scientist with many scientific organisations in this country, including the British Medical Association. In the 1880s or into the early 1890s, Galton developed the Life History Album, which in collaboration with the British Medical Association, which was the idea that it was important to monitor people's development physically over the course of their lifetime. So if you look at the Life History Album, it's kind of like a baby book, but for the whole of your life, with a set of, you take the measurements of a person when they are born, and then you follow them sort of at 5-yearly increments over the course of 70 years, which is amusingly biblical, for what is supposed to be a scientific document. And the data that was gathered through the Life History Album, but also by Galton through his anthropometric laboratory, that was later the Eugenics Records Office at University College London, later the Galton Laboratory at University College London. The way in which we gather this data that feeds into our health system comes from this place. Now, is it the case that the data are somehow tainted? Of course not. Data can speak for itself. But everything that we've all been talking about up until this point is highlighting the colonial frame that still exists when it comes to teaching medicine, when it comes to medical research. The big mistake that Galton made when he looked at his data sets was that he assumed, because he was a racist and a colonialist, was that he assumed what he was looking at was the result of a natural experiment, that black people were somehow naturally inferior because he was looking at them from a position of them being recently freed from enslavement, or understanding them as enslaved people. He looked at one of the main questions that informed his research was, how is it that so many rich and intelligent people in British society go on to have rich and intelligent children? And he saw this, his explanation for it was the basis for how we now understand the heritability and the genetics of intelligence. It didn't occur to him that the reason why rich people have rich children is because of the benefits of inherited wealth. It's all of these things that we need to be just a bit more clever. And in point of fact, I would argue we all need to be a bit more scientific in how we approach the information that we are presented with and the data that we gather. So is it the case that all people who are in the medical profession are eugenicists? Absolutely not. But we need to be mindful of these entangled histories and the frame of how we look at the data that we collect.
Amali.
Can I just actually add to further those sort of ideas is a paper that I published in the BMJ regarding induction of labour with the knowledge that black and brown women die more than white women. There was a draft guideline that needed commenting on a couple of years ago, and it was just assumed that, again, from data from people and women who had undergone severe structural racism, that black and brown women may go into labour a bit earlier than white women. But that was never the kind of structural racism was never extracted as a confounder. And then you have this classification of a slightly different body. And then that sort of thinking being iterated within the discussions of the draft, saying, well, why don't we just induce these black and brown women earlier? And that would solve it. And that sort of actually narrows the choices of black and brown women, and never actually extracted the structural racism from perhaps those population data. We need new data, new data with the eye of structural racism in order to formulate plans that help and reduce mortality and morbidity in populations. And we've got to be careful about not perpetuating This is. I'm quoting from an author called Sadana in The Lancet, who wrote a paper called Not Race-Based Medicine. We need race-conscious medicine. Race-based medicine is full of assumptions based on sort of the broken bodies argument. And that's what we need before looking at national policies to address the inequity we see between ethnic groups, for instance, in the UK.
Annabelle.
So I think it is something that's really hard for people to say, but, you know, my book is quite clear and my work is quite clear. I think eugenics is clearly highly influential still within the medical system, particularly in the UK. I think what the problem is that there's still a real denial that eugenics actually was a racial theory and a system of racism, particularly in the UK. In other parts of the world, such as South Africa or Australia, where the histories of the eradication of like indigenous populations or quite clearly eugenic law was introduced, there is less of a denial because it's a bit more overt. Whereas in the UK, because we did not have any obvious eugenic law policy, that people have kind of denied it. However, there were undertones in policies that we did have. It was clear, you know, that there were fears around migration when we had, you know, the British Britain citizenship being given to people in the colonies, that there was a fear of like white replacement and things like that, and how that's fed into some of the policies that we still have today. I think the distinction that people need to be really clear about is how eugenics links with race and colonialism. And I think sometimes people cannot make all of those connections themselves. And I think things like this are really important, so people can start to understand how those things all interact together to reinforce the systems of oppression and division that we are still having today.
Sirusha.
I want to support everyone's argument by in some ways disagreeing with you, but in my disagreement, supporting what you're saying, in the sense that I think that both, however this happens, it seems that the other is blamed, the other being the other in the capital O, is blamed for the violence that is inflicted on them. And I think the problem stems not from science, because science is not objective. I don't think even the problem stems from the structure and systems. The problem stems, for me at least, from the fact that the other hasn't been present as a dominant and shaping force in these structures for long enough. So, I mean, look at this panel. 10 years ago, this panel would not have existed. Us three would not have been asked for our opinion and our reflection. And the world will change because we are here. Not that the structures have changed, not that the systems have changed, but we bring with us our histories. So for structures and systems to change, the other needs to become part of the system. The other needs to be the person, and I'm speaking of myself as the other as well, and people that share the otherness, needs to become part of changing the system. And that will take generations, because we have to shed the mantle of our own colonization so that future generations of women and Black people and disabled people and brown people do not hold this internal colonization, that they don't remember the colonization in their very selves. And that takes generations. It's not going to happen soon enough. So more than the structure, more than the system, people need to change because they bring their lived experience histories with them.
Okay, so we've been hearing about the legacy of colonialism, but what do we need to do? How can we decolonize clinical care? What would you like to see happen, Annabelle?
Yes, of course. So it's a challenging one because I think, you know, on the more bleak side of the spectrum, a less optimistic side of the spectrum, a lot of us ask whether it's actually really possible to get to, you know, our decolonized utopia, as it were, when there are still so many persistent forces at play that are reinforcing these divisions. So we talk about decolonizing, but ultimately, the more of this work you do, the more you realize that we're still very much living in a system of colonialism and how much neo-colonial policy still exists. So whether that's, you know, we talk about, you know, drugs, and we saw this very much play out during COVID with vaccinations, that, you know, we have countries where they are used very much for medical research, development of drugs, even production of drugs. So we saw, you know, mass production of vaccines in India, things like that, but then actually not great distribution there. Another really big wave that did a lot of damage. We saw the same in South Africa. We talk about vaccine pools. So I think when we talk about decolonizing, increasingly I'm realizing that we're still very much talking about colonial policy, neo-colonial policy, and how we undo some of those harms. And I think the problem is that when we look at the marked health inequalities that we still have, both in the UK and elsewhere, there are still people that are trying to say that these are emerging on what is more of a level playing field because some of the divisions are less overt. So in some places like South Africa, people have more of their liberties, but there's still profound health inequalities. And so people will say, well, this is actually just a reflection of people not being good enough, not being able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And I think what we really need to work on is raising the awareness of how some of these policies, whether it is, you know, drug policy, housing policy, all of these things are actually still very much vestiges of kind of empire and how they are persistently reinforcing the inequity that we have. So I think that's the way forward for me, making people aware, because I do think there is a lot of, you know, people are not aware and they don't know that these underhanded things still exist. And that is probably a step forward. I very much educated a lot. I went through an education process, a re-education process, I call it, myself. I was looking in books. I was, you know, trying to ask people questions. And I don't think that people should have to do as much hard work as I've had to do to get to this point. I want it to be easier for people. So that's something I'm quite committed to.
Great. Thank you for that. And Marley, what do you think? What tangible actions can be?
Actions and processes. The whole thing of thinking that you can have a fix-it solution is very colonial. It's very hierarchical, codified, striated, very scientific thinking. It hasn't got the kind of rhizomatic, multi-stranded, relational kind of aspects that in terms of decolonization that people are saying we should recenter, such as indigenous thought, especially around the ecology of the planet and ecology around healthcare.
Sorry, maybe you could say a bit more about that, Amali, what a rhizomic approach or a grassroots approach looks like, and how is it colonialist to ask how we can foster that, how we can encourage that, or how we can
You can ask the question, but then the answers will come from the voices, will come from this group of people that you've asked to come to the table. And it can be messy. Decolonization is messy. You've got to be able to handle that messiness. You've got to handle the rage from the people who are oppressed, which means that one has to, the inquirer has to develop open and honest, listening, humble approach to the kind of ideas that may really be quite radical for people who have thought along Western hierarchical stratified ideas, like the whole kind of randomized control trial being the hierarchy of the best evidence. well, and qualitative research not being as important, but we really need to merge both of those to find people-centered solutions.
What is really important to understand is that decolonizing is not a top-down approach. And although, you know, the work of organizations like the BMJ internally are really important, and even higher education institutions decolonizing their curriculum, the thing is that actually a lot of communities have been saying or investigating this work for decades, and their issues and problems were not focused upon or taken seriously. And actually what's happened now is individuals like myself have realized that actually, you know, oh, there's all of this whole body of work and, you know, this stuff that we were ignoring that we should bring into our academic spaces and institutions and make these changes and shifts. And what I would say is that as somebody that transcends a lot of spaces in terms of, you know, going and doing community outreach work, listening to what people have to say and trying to get that into spaces to create change in real time, because that's why I started this process. I was in community groups, members of people that are not medics, have no connection to medics, probably have not actually ever met a Black doctor before, were saying things to me. And I realized there was a huge gap, a massive gap, a chiasm of understanding. And I said, let's try and make this happen quicker, because we're waiting for meta-analysis, we're waiting for evidence-based medicine, and we could be waiting for another 2 decades to create change.
Thank you, Annabelle. Sirusha?
I wonder if at this point, whether it would be worthwhile to just, you know, kind of see where we're at and kind of summarize where we're at. Because I was reflecting what and everyone says, and I think we agree that decolonizing is a messy process that is really essentially is affective in the sense that there's going to be a lot of emotional. It also must be essentially multi-generational because it is trying to undo inherited privilege. Because if we don't undo that inherited privilege, we'll end up redoing. And we find ourselves over generations redoing the work of decolonizing an imperialist the pervasiveness of imperialist hold. Because if you look at what's happening in the United States, civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, oh, it just keeps happening generation after generation. So it must be multi-generational. And speaking from South Africa, I can say that what we're struggling with at the moment is developing a sense of legacy around power in our context and our identity. Because what we don't have is inherited privilege. And if you don't have inherited privilege around your identity and health, if there is any threat to your identity and health, you immediately fall back down generations. If you cannot rely on your family's education, if you cannot rely on your family's history, if you cannot rely on your family's resources or your own education to maintain your position, if there's a health threat or the threat of war, you fall back down. I'm looking at myself. I don't need to look beyond myself. My family were indentured laborers, slaves, whatever you want to call it. And I'm the first generation of my family to have a postgraduate education, some high school education. And if I have to have any threat to my health or my identity, I will fall, and my children will have to start from way back again. So in the interest of that, I mean, I can't speak outside myself. I think that I could speak most authentically there. So in the interest of that, I would say that for me, what is important is changing the powerful actors. And that's going to be messy. We've seen that in South Africa. Changing powerful actors, just removing people, such as medical journal editors and researchers with historical privilege, shifting the balance of power in research spaces, as Amali and Annabelle have said, to patients, to communities, and dismantling physical and intellectual structures and institutions established on colonial epistemologies, in the sense that we don't need to do research in journals and in conferences. We could do that with music and art and community engagement, that what we find in our research needs to go straight first into the community as we engage with them. So it's going to be messy. It's a long process. It is necessarily multi-generational, or we will be doomed to repeat history. And it's not a history that I want to be part of.
Subhadra.
Yeah, I can't top that. So all I will do is I want to say I want to amplify what my colleagues here have all said. And I think in addition to the messiness and the community-centered and people-centered approaches, the one thing I would suggest as someone who is not a medical professional is what's the radical thing here is compassion, because what eugenics did was it turned us all into subjects. And those subjects became objects because of the previous existing ideas to do with race science. So I think compassion is a radical solution here. And the main thing to note is that there shouldn't be a single person who should have to demonstrate that they are deserving of compassion. Meritocracy assumes a level playing field. We all know that that level playing field doesn't exist. And so it's the fundamental thing here, in addition to everything that everyone has said, is that we need to approach people as they are and who they are, however difficult that might be, however challenging that might be, in systems that are also beyond medicine and healthcare. And that is really, I think, the only way that we move forward here, is that we have to learn to be a bit more kind to each other.
Many thanks indeed to our guests for joining us for this important and challenging discussion. This is the first episode in our series, and over the next few, we will consider our colonial history, the intersection with feminism, the way in which colonization has affected research conduct and outcomes, and what institutions should be doing with all the information we're learning, including the BMJ and our owner, the British Medical Association. We're also publishing articles on these topics, which you can access at bmj.com/decolonizing-health. And we'd love to hear your views on these topics. Let us know what decolonization means for you and your practice. You can leave a rapid response to any article on this topic on bmj.com. Bye for now.